Hello, my name is Ken Seaton. Welcome to Philanthropy Touch, a wonderful community of like-minded individuals that come together to share ideas, information, and hear inspirational speakers. You're about to hear something pretty amazing. I want to start with Mr. Zach Lotta, who I had a chance to meet several years ago. And I'd like you to introduce yourself, Zach, a little bit like kind of last night, and explain what you do.
Yeah, you bet. Well, first, I just want to say I'm so humbled with all of you. My internet's cut out. Can you all hear me?
Yeah, you're good,
Zach. Yep.
Cool. Well, I just want to say I'm so humbled to be with all of you here tonight. I'm calling in from Vermont, where we're doing our quarantine, but usually I'm based in San Francisco. So my name is Zach Lotta, and I run an organization called Hack Club. We are a nonprofit network of student-led high school hacker clubs. When you hear the word hacker, I'm not saying people who break into bank accounts. We're talking about unconventional problem solvers. Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, Grace Hopper, the people who created the computing revolution that has changed all of our lives, and the people that are going to define the next century. But the unfortunate reality right now is 60% of high schools in America don't offer any coding classes, and so many students, particularly from underrepresented schools, are being left behind. So Hack Club as a program is broken down into three key parts. The first is we help high school students start student-led after-school hacker clubs, where students get together every single week for 2 hours after school. There's 25 students in each club. It's all student-led. Students learn how to code in these clubs, but then they end up building projects every single week. It's like a mini hackathon. There are no teachers in Hack Club. And right now there are hack clubs in 2% of US high schools, and that number is growing by almost double every single year. The second part of our program is we run a massive online community. I don't know if any of you use Slack at your organizations, but we use Slack at Hack Club, but we invite all of our students to it. So right now we have over 7,000 students who are posting messages in our Slack almost every single day. There are millions of messages sent every single year. Students aren't only learning how to code together online. They're starting projects, they're starting nonprofits in their community. Most recently, we helped organize a response to the COVID-19 crisis that we're facing. It was an online hackathon that happened this past weekend. We partnered with Facebook, we partnered with Microsoft. There were 18,000 participants who participated, and we're currently getting an op-ed out that hopefully you'll read in one of the major newspapers in the next couple of weeks. And the third part of our program is that just like how if you're on a volleyball team in high school, not only the regional competitions and statewide competitions, and eventually national competitions, there's the exact same thing at Hack Club. We call them hackathons or 24-hour-long coding marathons that happen almost every single weekend in America. There's 122 of them that happen every single year in almost every major population center. And our students come together, work on projects, and build solutions for their communities at these events. I started Hack Club 6 years ago when I was 16. I had recently dropped out of high school. I was born and raised in LA County. Both my parents are social workers. My mom works in foster care, my dad in homelessness. So for all those here on the call who are working in both of those fields, I just wanna say I'm so grateful for the work that you're doing. LA in particular is, it's just so sad what's happening right now. And I think people need all the help they can get. I dropped out of high school. I moved up to San Francisco. I started Hack Club because it's what I so desperately wish I had when I was in school, because I went to public schools that didn't offer any coding classes, like 90% of schools at the time. And today we have 10,000 students in our programs each year. At this point, we're a multi-million dollar organization. Kent originally incorporated us when I was 16, and I'm so grateful for everything he's done for Hack Club. And I'm just so humbled to be on the call with all of you here tonight.
Zach, it's amazing for you to join us tonight. Thank you so much. By the way, I thought he was 18, okay? So forgive me that I dealt with a 16-year-old who's going to change the world. How many hack clubs do you have right now, total?
So there's over 400. They're in almost all 50 states. That's 2% of U.S. high schools. And then they're in 22 countries internationally. Primarily, recently, we've had a lot of growth in Africa.
Nobody should feel bad at all about where they're at in life at all. Zach is breaking the mold here. I know Joe is already regretting that he's going to go next here, but the reality is that what Joe's up to, especially Family Foundation, is amazing stuff. Joe, I want you to explain, you know, of course, what you are and in your sort of role there, but also how you've gone into inner cities from an educational standpoint and done things that are nuanced and aren't on people's map, and where you're headed now, which is so fascinating.
Great. Thanks, Ken. Just like Zach, I'm honored to be just on the call with everybody, let alone featured. My name is Joe Womack. I serve as president of a private family foundation, Specialty Family Foundation. We're headquartered here in the LA area, and most of our work as a funder is here in the LA area. I'll say that I thought I was the founder of a hack club, but not the computer hacking in this particular realm with all of the digital and technological work that people mentioned they're connected to. I'm feeling like a bit of a hack myself right now, but I'll just say I was also happy to hear there's a number of foundations on this call, because that's, I think, a perspective I could bring. We're an innovative, hopefully positively disruptive funder with a poverty mission. Our mission is to alleviate the conditions that lead to persistent poverty. We were founded about 15 years ago by a scientist and medical doctor who everything he did in life turned into gold. It was almost always something that had never been tried before, and almost always against the advice of everybody in his life, including the company he founded, which when it sold and went public, it created the liquidity moment that created our foundation. As Kent said, education is one of our foci. We believe in that broad mission of alleviating conditions that lead to persistent poverty, that we're not going to make much of a difference if we don't get very finitely niched. And so we're looking for pain points or opportunities connected to problems. And we believe that there's no path out of poverty for kids that don't have access to quality education. We think that it's kind of obvious that many, many inner city kids do not have that access. I think we just heard from Zach that he had some of that experience. And so we work really hard to try to find investment opportunities as a philanthropy that can move the needle on that issue. And I'll be happy to elaborate that some tonight. We also have a focus more recently on homelessness. And again, we're trying to find our role in that. And so as a funder, what we're not interested in is just finding really cool projects, because there's so many of those. We're interested in finding projects that need us. We have a $5 million budget, and we like to have an impact, seek to have an impact of perhaps an organization of about 10 times that funding size. And so in order to do that, we have to pick very carefully, take on a lot of risk, lose some figurative liquidity by committing ourselves to long periods of times to issues, and we partner up. We do a lot of collaborative funding, and often many of our projects have four or five nonprofits under one MOU.
Excellent, Joe. Thanks. And I'm going to want to talk a little bit about the Archdiocese stuff later. So just heads up on that.
Yeah, and I was happy to hear Crespi on the call here.
He's a supporter. Also, now we're going to move to our third and not final, but equal panelist, Amy. Amy and I were introduced by Josh. You can tell a little bit about Josh's founding of Nine Dots, of course, what the mandate of Nine Dots is, what makes you guys so special in this wonderful community of LA and education.
Thank you very much, Kent. Again, I agree with Zach and Joe. When I am with a group of people like this, I feel like if I were funding, I would have no idea where to put my money, because it's all so important. And thank you for having Nine Dots join the call. Nine Dots sort of sits at the intersection of what Joe is doing and what Zach is doing. Josh Taylor started it about 9 years ago, and it was inner city kids that they were teaching general STEM and leadership curriculum. And very shortly into running the program, they realized that a piece of the puzzle that wasn't getting the focus it needed was literal computer science within STEM, coding and programming. And so they started by going into one school and piecing together curriculum, sort of found pieces of curriculum. And 4 years later, we have built our own fully created curriculum, written all the lesson plans, all the narrative, the platform that it sits on. And we teach kindergarten through sixth graders computer science skills in Title I schools. So we're in 22 schools now, and we reach 6,500 kids. And basically, Nine Dots exists to close the equity gap in computer science. So if you think about what Zach said and you think about what Joe said, I often go to the numbers. I get passionate about the numbers. The growth of jobs for software developers from 2018 to 2028 is 3.5 times that of other jobs. the income, the mean income, is double. They're the highest growing jobs. They are the highest wealth creating jobs. And the current diversity today, 19% of software developers are women, 5% are Black, 6% are Latino and Latina. So at the same time that the jobs are exploding and the wealth is exploding, there's an inverse correlation between the percentage of low-income students in a school and the likelihood that their schools offer any CS education. 90% of the population we serve are children of color, 82% are low or very low income. But what I think is so, well, I'm biased, but what I think is so important about our program is that we're not actually just teaching kids computer science skills, but we're reaching them at an early enough age with an engaging narrative content that allows them to feel like they belong in a computer science class, that that's an area they could excel in. Children of color, girls drop out of science and math at a surprisingly young age. It's like second or third grade. So we build our classrooms around the premise that every child can be a coder, every child can succeed in complex problem solving, every child can grow up to be in a science field. One of the moments I love most when I drop into classes is that our teaching facilitators, when they call the class to order, when they ask a question, they don't say kids or students, they say coders, coders. And the kids say, yes, yes. And you look around the room and there's all these children who might not otherwise or wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity, so excited and engaged and believing they're part of computer science. So that's us.
Excellent, excellent. And these are sort of the opening remarks, if you will, and we'll get going here on this conversation. One sort of thing I want each of the panelists, and I'll sort of ask you the same sort of basic question, is that, you know, education, right, has such traditional formats, but yet each one of you is differently handling this intersection between tradition and ultimately innovation, and most importantly, the actual education and impact on these kids. So now I'm going to come back to the 16-year-old who's now not 16 anymore, who's brilliant. What do you say to that? What are your comments around that, Zach? And how are you approaching things differently? And then include in that, how are you measuring that impact? How do you know you're doing good, right?
100%. So I think that starting 10 years ago, something changed in education that nobody's talking about. And what that is suddenly every single young person in the world, and at this point, it is a majority of people in the world. And within the next 50 years, it's going to be every single person in the world. But suddenly every single young person started getting access to all of human history and knowledge in their pockets. And I think this changes everything. When I was 7, I taught myself how to code. My parents aren't coders. I went to public schools that didn't teach computer science. And that's because access was a solved problem. And I think over the past 100 years through the public school system, we have built a enormous efficient system to solve the problem of access. How do we simply get access to all of the knowledge that we want young people to learn in front of them? We've built a top-down one-to-many system, and I think it's really served its purpose. Every single person learns to read and write, almost. There's still literacy issues, and that's remarkable. But I think today the problem is no longer access. The problem is that with all of human history knowledge at their fingertips, young people are choosing to use Instagram, not unlock the secrets of the universe. And I think the way the Hack Club approaches this is that we think the new problem is no longer in all of education, but in coding in particular, is no longer a question of how do you get access, but a question of utilization. How do you get students to care? How do you get students to be motivated? So the way we've designed Hack Club's program, and the reason why it's student first, it's all student led, it's all opt-in, it's structured as an after-school club at the schools that the program's implemented in, is that it has to be fun. So in Hack Club, we structure the program to solve the motivation problem. In every single meeting, students leave the 2.5-hour club meeting having built a project. So there's tangible outputs from day one. No coding experience is required to join. And there's a huge, heavy emphasis on community. You're making new friends. Students who have the experience you want them to have in Hack Club tell us that Hack Club was a time when not only did they figure out who they were as a coder, but they figured out who they were as a person. I think in so many ways, what we're trying to do through Hack Club is build an organization that will be as culturally foundational and as universal for today's generation as a Girl and Boy Scouts were for the previous. It's a community first approach, it's a student first approach, and above all else, we're working to solve the motivation problem.
Yeah, that's a great answer, Zach. And Joe, I'm going to bounce to you. Obviously, I have a little sort of inside knowledge about how you do things in a special way, but it's the same question. You know, this traditional environment, what are you doing? Tell us more.
So first of all, I'll say we have had for most of our history and still do an emphasis on low-income serving inner city Catholic elementary schools. That's a lot of niche there. The reason for that is, generally speaking, that when we look at education, we're looking for schools that have already at the outset a tradition of positive impact on the most marginalized groups. And so these are schools that were founded in mostly the 1800s and early 1900s to deal primarily with low-income immigrant groups. And they don't have mission statements that stop at curriculum. In fact, their mission statements don't get to curriculum until they've passed about four or five priorities first. So if the kids are hungry when they get to school, then they add it to the mission statement to feed them. If the school day ends and they go home to empty houses, then they add it to the mission statement to keep them. If in the summertime there's learning that's lost, then they add to the school year. Many of our schools have an 11-month school year. And then also there's not public resource there. They don't receive any public support. And so we have 80,000 students attending Catholic schools in Los Angeles. 50% of those students are at or below the poverty level. So we have over 100 schools that are 75% low-income serving, and they're a diminishing group. These schools have been closing and losing enrollment for about 40 years. And so we chose to enter this space because these schools have a tradition of 98% graduating with 97% continuing to the next level. So if you go to Catholic high school, you will almost guaranteed graduate and go to college. The question is can we get you there? If you go to Catholic elementary school, chances are you're going to high school. And so we look at education and we say, what are the bottom line outcomes? What's the goal of education? And we certainly care about test scores as indices. We care about retention and attendance rates and other statistics. But more than any statistic, we care about what happens to kids that go to schools like that. What's the delta? If you remove that school from a person's life, what happens to the life? If you insert that school into the person's life, what happens to it? And those are things that really have caused us to enter that space generally. We also enjoy the fact that it's not the academics that are broken in those schools usually. It's the finances and it's the business model and it's the enrollment numbers. But actually, academically, things tend to be going better. And so it's harder to fix academics at a school level than it is to fix some of the other viability stuff. So that's why we've gotten in there. I'll finish by saying, so that's a general explanation for why we've entered into a space. And the role that we played in that is to pick schools that are struggling, that others don't want to work with, who have often new leadership, who understand the problems they've inherited, but do not have any pride in authorship. And we will often approach four or five schools and end up with one or two relationships that last a long time. If we can shake hands and say what we are hoping to achieve over a five-year period, what success would look like in a measurable and accountable way, shake hands on that, then we will make a long-term commitment to helping turn a school around. And we've had some good success with that. I'll finish by saying at a finite level, we do a lot of small grant making, individual grant making across dozens of schools. And we take a case by case approach. And I love what I'm hearing about the programs on my fellow panelists, because they're the kinds of programs that we often support externally to the schools or we push into the schools for the very reasons that they were mentioning. An example is we often send the kids in the summers and during the school days out of the inner city. We get them to the beach, we get them to the museums, we get them to week-long outdoors camps. It's about exposure, and that's so much what they were saying on the coding stuff. And just one story. Last year, every year we send about a couple hundred fourth to sixth graders to the symphony. And I hadn't gotten down there to see them enjoying this, even though we were sending them to Disney Concert Hall every year. And I went down to watch the symphony as a special performance for that age group. And I went down to watch the kids arrive and watch the symphony with them last year as they were coming off of the buses and getting on the elevators underneath the symphony hall and coming up the elevators and coming out of them into the foyer before they've even entered the symphony concert hall. And I watched as more than one child came out of the elevators from the schools we support, and their jaws had already dropped. Because as they got off the elevators, these fourth to sixth graders, I don't know how old they were, somewhere between fourth and sixth grade, had just had their first elevator ride. And so the question in my head is, how does that child see themselves in one of those towers downtown as a lawyer, as an accountant, or in the symphony hall as a musician, if they haven't in their lifetime even gotten in an elevator before? So for us, we really do believe that the work that many of you on this call are connected to is the difference maker, because you're providing exposure to kids that not only teaches them about the coding or about the other stuff, but it's actually showing them that inside them is a coder. And that for us is what it comes down to. It's really about getting kids exposed to themselves through experience.
Beautiful stuff, Joe. I love it. Amy, hate to put you after these two guys, but
I know.
Look it away. You're really kind of entered in a traditional world here. So tell us more how you guys do it.
Well, what's exciting is that oftentimes we come into a school because parents in that community have advocated or asked the teachers, the principals, to bring computer science in. There's a recognition that it's important in our current life and our future life and their children's future, and they want us there. We have great partnerships with principals, with teachers. The head of Compton's technology for the whole district is an unbelievable woman who has tremendous foresight in what she sees that her kids can do and should be doing. So we step into a place in traditional education where people see the value. What we are doing, though, we've got teachers that are teaching English, math, social studies. They're teaching every subject. There need to be experts in every subject. And almost across the board, computer science is not something they're terribly comfortable with. So we have set up our programs that we not only have the curriculum and the platform, but we go into schools and the first year, our teachers teach the class and the teacher, the schoolroom teacher, watches our teacher. The second year, the teacher that belongs in that classroom teaches the class and our teacher coaches, essentially. We have other professional development, we have courses, and we're in a gradual release model so that by the third year, our teachers are teaching independently to their classes. I mean, there's so many moments that I love about what we're doing. We were talking to one teacher who was partial support, what we call them when they're teaching the class on their own half the time. And she told us that she sends her kids to spy on other classrooms where one of our teachers is so that she can get more coding hints so that they can help her teach the class. There's also this amazing thing that happens in our classrooms where kids are collaborating. They're walking around the room, helping each other try to solve problems. Which of course happens in coding. There's a piece where we see kids that don't necessarily see themselves shining in other subjects, but computer science reaches a part of them that maybe math or science doesn't. And when you look at kids who have English as a second language, I was in a classroom recently where I asked one of the little boys a question and the girl next to him said to me, oh, he only speaks Spanish. And she translated a little, but then I watched him and I watched him light up as he moved himself through the playlist at a greater rate than the kids around him. Because this is something he didn't need English for, and yet he could feel successful and understand that this was an area he could shine in. So kids find themselves in different ways, and our platform and our curriculum and the way we work with teachers and in traditional classrooms is allowing them to find that. I don't know if that fully answered your question, Kent.
That's wonderful, Amy. Thank you. I appreciate you sharing about that.
Oh, let me tell you one more anecdote. When Joe talked about the elevator story, we also have corporations and funders, as all of you do. And we recently took a classroom trip to Headspace. So I don't know if some of you talked about meditation or breath work. Headspace is an app that it's a meditation app. And their space, as you might imagine for a tech startup, is incredibly cool. They have a swinging table with swinging chairs next to it. They have this courtyard where they do their meditation at 10 o'clock every day. We brought a classroom of kids, fifth grade kids from Compton. And the way the day was structured between us and Headspace was that first they had their coders being taught by our kids on a big screen, various different coding concepts, loops and functions. The next moment was their coders telling our kids exactly how they use loops and functions in their product. And to Joe's point, it just felt like a pivotal moment in these kids' lives that they could see people like them. There were a diverse group of engineers that spoke, and they could see that this could be their future if this was a path they wanted to pursue, and they did pursue. So to Joe's point, when children see the opportunities, those are amazing moments.
So far, you've been listening to an amazing, amazing dialogue right now, and I hope you guys are pulling something from it. It's not only a chance to hear from wonderful people, but it's also a chance for you to think about the things that you're doing with your charitable social impact organization and how to improve. We're going to kind of get into the unfortunate heat of the moment for everybody in the world right now. COVID happens, right? It happens to you guys as an organization. We're not going to get on the personal stuff, but on this sort of thing now, and you're like, oh my God, what do I do? Right. So talk a little bit about that moment, because everybody on this call is having that moment, by the way. Not one of us has not felt that way. And then the second thing, which I want you to address, hopefully as eloquently as you've had the other responses, is what's the pivot? What are you thinking as an organization, as a team? Do you see opportunities? Take us down that road a little bit. I'm gonna come back to the whiz kid himself, Mr. Latta. What are you seeing out there?
COVID's crazy. So I think I can kind of sum up. Hacklab's done a lot in the past 2 weeks in response to this. We've of course had to completely change our structure. 3 weeks ago, we had 400 schools with the programs in it. We had somewhere between 7 and 10,000 students attend those programs every single week. And today, there's zero, because schools, not only in America, but all across the world have shut down. Right now, today in America, there are 56 million students outside of school. And for the schools that have their programs together, have lots of resources, private schools, homeschooling started last week. For the really good public schools, homeschooling started this week. For the vast majority of schools that Hack Clubbers are in, we're very representative. I mean, just like most schools in America, 70% of our students are in schools with the majority of students on free reduced lunch. Things are still trying to be figured out. So right now in this moment, we sat down as a team. We had hours and hours and hours of team discussions. And we decided that our goals as Hack Club were to do three things. The first is to fill the education gap, because Hack Club was filling a technology education gap for every single student that was in our program. The vast majority of students in Hack Club don't have computer science classes at their schools. So we need to make sure that that education continues. The second goal is to fill the mental health gap. The reality is Hack Club is now at the size where we're gonna have a student who gets COVID. And we're gonna have many students who have families that are affected by COVID. And we're gonna have many, many students whose family's socioeconomic position and financial position is affected by COVID. And for the students that have the experience we're most proud of in Hack Club, a huge part of it is it's so much more than just a place where you're getting curriculum, and so much more a place where you're learning a new skill. Hack Club is the closest, most important social network for thousands and thousands of students in Hack Club. So we need to make sure that online, that community continues, and if anything, it gets stronger. So Hack Club's there for them when the institutions and friend groups that they relied on elsewhere are no longer. The third goal that we have is that you have 7,000 technical teenagers all across America and essentially every single zip code, every single major population center at Hack Club is in it. And right now, every single local business in this country is struggling to move online. We've already had Hack Clubbers reach out to local communities to train businesses like grocery stores to use to do grocery pickup via email, or working with local businesses that run classes to switch those classes to online Zoom classes. One thing we did for this was we partnered with Facebook and we partnered with a number of other large corporations to run an 18,000 person global COVID response hackathon in partnership with the World Health Organization this past weekend. There were thousands of projects that came out of it. In total, it was nearly 2,000 projects submitted. And the official website for the event that's going to be announced in 7 days from now was built by a teenager in Hack Club. So high level, those are the three goals that we have. And every single day we've released new programming for our students. Actually, as I'm with all of you on the call, downstairs in the apartment that I'm renting right now, one of my team members is on a call with about 50 of our students running a coding workshop. I'm hearing the voice from up the stairwell. And ultimately our goal right now is we want to make Hack Club the most inclusive and the most friendly place to be a technical teenager or someone who wants to become a technical teenager on the internet. So that's how we're framing our approach, and already our online student activity has more than doubled over the past 2 weeks.
Amazing stuff, Zach. Thank you so much for sharing. Who's not happy they're on the call? Wish they were off the call. This is the kind of stuff that you need to hear right now, guys.
Wait till I talk.
Can't wait. We're gonna get there for sure. But again, Zach, in all seriousness, appreciate your participation tonight. Joe,
sure.
Same question.
Yes. So we're a funder, and we fund from a permanently invested fund that usually is between $70 and $80 million. There are contributions that go into there sometimes. And so we immediately lost $10 to $15 million from that, and had to have a quick discussion with our board and with ourselves about whether this was a moment for us to pull the belt loop tighter, or whether it was a moment for us to not worry about that. And we've made the decision to hold the line on our funding budget for the year, if not increase it. Part of that comes from a permanent philosophy we bring to all of our work, which is that we are, as a funder, it's a one-way street. No one exists, no one will ever be founded to support us. But every single thing we do is to support somebody else. So it's a one-way street. And so in a moment like this, when the world is hurting, when individuals are hurting, when organizations that are heroic are put at risk because they run paycheck to paycheck, and maybe their event got canceled this year, or they're very volunteer laden in their work and volunteers are at home, or they are a tuition driven school and people aren't paying tuition if they're not going. So how are they going to pay their teachers? How are they going to pay? So we have a huge concern, not for ourselves in a moment like this, but for our grantees and for those that they serve. And we must put them in front of our existence even. And so the first decision we made was not to cut, to reallocate. Would we have made this budget had we known this was coming? And the answer is obviously no. And we did a whole quarter of the year's worth of grants from January to March. So before we got to those, we immediately said, what are we going to do quickly? Because this has some quick impact. And so we, as a staff, I have four staff members that are full-time and then a board of 11. We went through the list of all of our grantees, and each of us brought to a special meeting two grantees. One that we were going to argue was put most at risk by this moment, and would need quick and not laborious support from us. And the other, I asked them to come with, who is Valvoline? And what I meant by that was that from the first days of this COVID crisis, I get my oil changed coincidentally at Valvoline. And they're the only drive-up oil change. You don't have to roll your window down. You don't have to have contact with another human being. You can get your oil changed. There are organizations, this Zoom, I'm guessing, is thriving in this moment, that actually were made for this moment. And I was wanting to know not who is at risk, but who's going to be the savior of this moment, and how can we help them build their capacity? So just some examples, I don't have time. We had a special board meeting last week, and those organizations are mostly not educational. So we pulled out, for instance, St. Vincent Meals on Wheels. They're the largest Meals on Wheels organization in the country. They're right here in LA. They every day visit thousands of elderly people in their homes and feed them lunch, dinner, and pet food. It's the same person volunteering that pulls up every day and says, how you doing, Mr. Smith? And so they're an organization that is made for this moment. They are delivering people their meals every day to their houses. They were already running 2 8-hour shifts in the kitchen they run, and they wanted to add a third shift. So we bought them a freezer truck. And they've added a third shift so they can cook all night long and freeze that food. And they've already added 33% to their client list during this moment. So it was immediately $50,000 to $75,000 that's already fed thousands of meals to an additional couple hundred people. We're very happy to have done that. We also contacted Venice Family Clinic. They serve over 25,000 unduplicated clients in Venice Beach and on the west side through several clinics every day. About half those clients are homeless or have experienced homelessness in the last 6 months. This is a very, very endangered group in a moment like this, because not only are they smoking in higher percentages, dealing with pre-existing conditions that put them at a higher risk rate, and also not getting primary health care and being malnourished. These are all things that lead to mortality in COVID, but also they have really, really serious health conditions that are harder to deal with. And so Venice Family Clinic gets $1.6 million a month in Medicaid support from Medi-Cal. It's only allowed to be reimbursed for face-to-face services, and they're doing it all telephonically for their diabetes care, for their all their cares. And so we bought their entire staff laptops, and then also are supporting their advocacy division, which is trying to get that regulation changed, because that's half of their payroll every month. I'll finish by saying in education, we're just getting to that agenda because we feel that it's important, but not as important as those more marginalized homelessness and poverty interventions and food security interventions. That what we did is last Thursday, rather than extending grants out yet, we invited 15 foundations totaling about $4 billion in assets. So we're just 100 million, just under that, to a meeting with the superintendent and the Archbishop of the Archdiocese. And every single foundation's principal decision maker came and came onto a 90-minute call with the superintendent of schools to hear his ask. And we understand that they've already gotten almost $20 million from that meeting that we called. And so we haven't yet given the grants out, but we thought, what's the quickest thing we can do for the schools? And we use our social capital, not our capital. And we invited all of our funding friends and asked them on behalf of the superintendent, who's not the most asking type of person, if they would listen to his pitch. And that's how we've done this to this point. Next week, we're going to extend our grants to schools. We're not there yet.
Yeah, before you go, Andy, let me a quick comment. You know, Joe, just because he's sort of the sole funder or represents the sole funder on the panel, I figured you guys would find his perspective also interesting, different but interesting. Why I invited Joe on the panel even further, as you're beginning to uncover, is a very deep perspective on philanthropy, and it's not just writing checks. And I really wanted the folks on this call that are public charities that are looking to seek funds from foundations who are funders, so to speak, that it can be deep and it can be very intelligent, creative, collaborative. That's a big word, collaborative. I'm going to come to that at the end. But I just wanted to anchor some things because it's a very different perspective than most people are used to hearing, because foundations typically don't come on these calls. They're scared. Joe, by the way, is wearing a mask. He actually looks like John Travolta underneath that. Okay, he doesn't want you to know who he is. Okay? All right. Sorry about that. I just wanted to give a little plug for Joe.
Thanks.
No worries. I love what Zach and Joe are both doing. So thrilled to be able to hear it. Well, obviously, every COVID lesson is happening in real time. When I realized today that autocorrect doesn't even know that COVID is an actual word. So it's unfolding quickly. And like most elementary school education, our entire program is place-based. We're either in schools or we're at our own site where we bring kids in after school for our academy, kids that we're not teaching in class with. And as software developers and program managers, contingency plans and mitigation strategies are sort of core to our DNA. So for the last 2 weeks, we've been trying to restructure and rethink how we can teach our kids in CUSD and LAUSD along with what the district is doing. We've been restructuring our class lessons so they're taught in video by our teachers, so that the teachers that are assigning lessons, they're real teachers in their class, still don't have to have the computer science expertise, even though they're remote and we're remote, we're one level removed. We're piloting our teaching right now to each other, which is kind of fun. And we teach an AP computer science principles course to middle schoolers. It's a high school course. We teach it to middle schoolers at our academy. And we've already moved that group to synchronous teaching online. And they'll be able to take their AP tests online as well. So our hope is that we'll be able to have pivoted quickly enough and successfully enough that we'll get through all of our school curriculum with all of our kids. It's a big goal, but it's been learning in a lot of different ways. It's given us some thoughts about how we might be able to reach after school kids differently through distance learning in a way we're not. We spent a lot of time thinking about what bus routes we take so that we can pick up which kids to bring them to our after-school program, and maybe there's opportunities there. It's sort of renewed our understanding that, to Zach's point, for high school kids or, you know, maybe even middle school kids, they can do a lot of education themselves. But for elementary school kids, distance learning is, parents are critical to distance learning. And with a population that has parents who may be working more hours, maybe speak English as a second language, maybe haven't finished high school themselves, we really have to create a national product, which we're working on, that allows elementary school children to learn computer science in school, because the distance learning opportunity is harder for this set of kids, and they'll more easily be left behind. The other thing is we have a platform which tracks how kids are doing, and so we're going to use this opportunity to see how video lessons dropped into our lesson plans, how effective those are. We'll be able to see what the progress is like for kids who are seeing our instructors on video and then doing their own playlist, as opposed to having our teacher in class. So, like everybody, we're trying to continue the work in a different form, but we're also trying to get as much learning as we can out of it to see if it allows us to innovate once COVID-19 is hopefully a thing of the past.
Thank you so much, Amy, for that and wonderful response, and appreciate it. Guys, I don't know about you, but you know the time is, believe it or not, we're almost at an hour and a half. I've got a couple minutes for Q&A from our digital audience. Some of you, you know, there's a little hand, electronic hand, if you click on participants, and you can say if you have a question or not. If you don't have any questions, which right now I don't see any, maybe just speak up real quick. We're going to only take about two or three. And so it doesn't look like anybody's coming out. If you are, just one sec. Otherwise, we're going to kind of close right now. Again, I really
can you hear me?
Yeah, Ryan. Yeah, go for it.
One question: the young man who's doing the coding had said that he's looking kind of phase two mental health, and I agree. I mean, that's going to be a major issue. It was an epidemic prior to this, and now it's really everyone's going to know it. How are you going about incorporating mental health with your coding clubs?
Yeah, 100%. So 1 in 20 high school students seriously considers committing suicide. That's the stat before COVID. I got off the phone with a high school student that hasn't been outside of their home, not even to on the sidewalk or in a backyard in the past 4 days earlier today. So I think we're going to really see loneliness setting in pretty soon. The way that we're approaching it is we think that it's all about friendships. So our goal is that for every single engaged Hack Club student, right now, there are about 3,000 that are online engaged in our programs that we've transitioned to the internet. For every single one of those students, we want them to make a friend, a real meaningful friend through Hack Club. What we've been doing is running video calls almost every single day. That's what I mentioned earlier. We have a coding challenge going on downstairs right now. And in every single one of these calls and in every single activity that we're doing in our online chat community, we're creating opportunities for people to go offline out of the main call and talk with other students one-on-one. Already, Caleb, who's a student whose dad is an Uber driver, didn't have internet access or laptop at home. We have a laptop donation program to get our students who are in need access to computers and internet, who we donated a laptop to, has become friends with Matthew, who's from West Lafayette, Indiana, and whose mom's a professor at the university. They've been talking every single night for an hour for the past week. So those are exactly the kinds of relationships that we're trying to build right now. And what we're doing is creating lots of opportunities for students to get together in groups, both in chats and in Zoom calls, creating lots of opportunities for the students to talk one-on-one afterwards. And we think it's working.
Well, you know, Jewel.
Yeah, go ahead.
And her kids just started an online mental health platform. So if you want to connect with Kent, we're happy to extend it to you.
That would be fantastic. I'd love to follow up on that.
And I'll connect you guys for sure. We have time for, believe it or not, only one more question. If you have it, just kind of speak up and say it, because I think there's a little issue with the electronic hands. Oh, actually, Catherine Adams, I see your hand up. You have one electronic hand. You're the last question. I'm going to wrap it up, guys, so don't leave. I have a couple comments, and then we'll be done. But go ahead, Catherine.
You know, Joe had mentioned the uncomfortable difficulty of pivoting and having to change who you're funding and shift priorities. I'm wondering from Amy or Zach, if you've similarly had issues, but kind of from the budgeting end, since you're doers, not funders, in terms of prioritizing how your budget's going to work during this crisis.
Amy, do you want to take this?
Sure. Yep. Well, we're in a pretty fortunate position that we've gotten some big grants. We've gotten corporate grants. We've got some really strong donors. And we were already in a position where we were tightening our belt before this, because we are pivoting to building a national product, and we wanted to have some runway to be able to do that. So how that transforms in the next 6 months, I think, will have a lot to do with whether we're all getting back to work in 2 months or 8 months. But at the moment, we've been okay, and we've been, you know, very transparent with our current funders about, you know, how the program is different now. Verizon funded our APCSP program. We've talked to them. It's kind of exciting that we can also tell them now how that worked remotely. And we'll have the same different kinds of metrics to share with them, but similar. So we're okay for now, but I recognize that, you know, this is going to be a tough time, and this is going to be a time when all of us are going to have to prioritize what the most important work we're doing is, because there's so much need.
I can jump in from the Hack Club perspective too. So we are similarly very fiscally conservative and always have been. We started with me and my co-founder at the time, me sleeping on an airbed, him sleeping on the floor in the same bedroom in an apartment with 12 roommates in San Francisco to save money on rent. And that culture has been with us ever since. One of the rules that we've had when we fundraised over the past 6 years is that we only accept unrestricted dollars. We never accept a restricted contribution. And we are a primarily major gifts operation. So the founder of GitHub, who's a billionaire at this point, is on our board and very supportive. And we have a variety of Silicon Valley funders like that that have stepped in to support our work in a way that we're very grateful for. So what this means for us today is I am feeling so glad right now that this is the approach we took, because we have more than 16 months of cash in the bank right now, and that's with no reduced spend. And what we've been doing is actually starting 2 weeks ago, we started making asks of all of our largest major supporters, and we've gone out to our extended network. And we've actually had a number of people step up their contributions, because we've seen every family is looking for a way to make a meaningful difference in COVID. And right now, last week, the focus was on PPE for frontline workers, which is absolutely the right focus. This week, that's going to be the focus too. Within 2 weeks from now, homeschooling is going to be the big topic. And everybody wants an education piece to this. Right now, most school districts haven't figured it out. And we think Hack Club really works at this moment for students around the country. So for example, Ron Conway, who was the first check into Google, we're very grateful for him. He stepped and made his first contribution to Hack Club last week, and we're hoping to get many more people like him to do that same thing.
Can I put an oar in the water, just even though the question wasn't for a funder? Real quick. I love those answers. I just also want to say one of the mantras that we bring to all of our nonprofits that we talk to is recognize the crisis, identify the crisis, absolutely try to solve the crisis, but don't waste the crisis either. It's in crisis that organizations are the most open to change. And so there's a real opportunity when things get so discombobulated to put them back, the ingredients back together differently, and to find out that you can actually find silver linings everywhere. The other thing is that, you know, we just had a question before this one on mental health. And there's also a tremendous opportunity to highlight things that are every day right in front of us. And I really hope that we don't go back to normal. Normal wasn't so great before all of this, if you want my opinion. And we haven't been having the best 2019 and 2020 as a country and as a world. And so I kind of hope personally that we don't get back to normal. We get back to a new normal where people have a better day-to-day appreciation for the importance of mental health, for the importance of balance in their lives, and the role that they can play in that for themselves and others. And I just think it's really important to focus on all that. And the last thing I'll say is I see a lot of organizations using the playbook, and I would say it's in time to question the playbook, which is not always working anyway. I think about that when the Fed is going all over the place with their interest rates and stuff. You know, this is not like a situation that has precedence. And so getting out of it with precedented tactics may be a risk. And so I'm very interested in helping organizations, not towards a specific direction, but towards a general looking at a situation more broadly, innovatively, and not wasting the moment, which is a moment where you can really do a lot, actually.
Guys, I can't thank the panelists enough. I honestly, this has been an absolutely amazing panel. I was just texted by somebody who I know very well. There's been a lot of the panel stuff I've done for the last 22 years. Mm. No joke, 22 years I've been doing this. Amazing panel. I want to anchor a couple points. This is, Joe, your ending comments were kind of everything. I don't think I really need to say too much more. This is, you know, just a tremendous chance to take advantage of the sort of opportunity, you know, even though it's devastating in a different way, and to look at the silver lining, look at the lessons, but don't waste it. You know, really look systemically at yourself and your organizations. Again, we're not talking personal, but just the way society runs, and make this meaningful, as opposed to something that says, okay, we're back to status quo, and let's relax again, right? And you got Ryan Wolfington who's trying to change, all these wonderful people on this call, Joe Balla, great people trying to do good work and come together. So that's really important. So thank you guys for the sort of anchoring that point for all of us tonight, because I think we're all going to think differently, and I appreciate it. I also want to encourage you guys that this community that we have, there could be a part two to this, by the way. You know, the panelists could say, I'll come back in 6 months and do a part two with you. If I get enough consensus on it, we may do it, by the way. I think it might be a good idea. I've never thought of that ever with any panelist to do a part two, because there's just so much to talk about here. There's so much potential collaboration, something Tamara Brown and I have been talking about too. How do you collaborate? How do you make each other better, these enterprises? Because one may have an amazing curriculum like Amy, and another has this incredible out-of-the-box thinking, right, using Slack and incredible engagement with the kids and the youth, right? And all this, and then a different viewpoint from the funder mentality, but just thoughtful stuff. So this community is important. I urge you to stick within this community that we have. I've been doing this a long time. Some of you don't realize I've been doing it this long. First time you've been on a call. That's why I said first time callers. Don't realize I'm very involved in the community. Been doing this a long time. This organization called Athletes Touch, which Philanthropy Touch is part of the greater one, has been around for over 12 years. And it's wonderful. We'll have some great speakers coming up. I have an accelerator program that's amazing for people if they want to go through that. CJ will get you called that, kind of all that information. But again, I thank you guys. We're trying to stop right now because it's 7:36 and I like to end on time. Thank you guys again. Thank you, the panelists. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, CJ, for your great work. Have a great evening, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ken. Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Wow, what an amazing amount of content we just heard around philanthropy. What a wonderful story. What a wonderful opportunity for you guys to hear this and find ways to help your organizations or the people that you're involved with do better, have more impact, and change the world.